Good afternoon, everybody. I'm John Vickers, Warden of the College, and I would first like to welcome you all, Jim's family, friends, colleagues, former students and admirers, to this celebration of his life and work. I particularly want to thank our speakers this afternoon. As you see from the programme, we have a trio of duos. Anna Shahood and Alan Bowman will speak about Jim's career before Oxford, or more properly speaking, before his return to Oxford, because Jim, of course, was a graduate student at Brasenose across the square in the late 1960s. Then Rosemary Hill and Wolfgang de Mello will focus on Jim at Oxford, particularly here at this college in All Souls. And then Kathleen Coleman and Beppe Pezzini will cover Jim's intellectual legacy, both for Latin studies in general and for his students and early career scholars in particular. I myself had the pleasure of being a colleague of Jim's here for almost 20 years. And in that time, there was a lot of cricket to talk about. It is fair to say that Jim was not hail fellow well met, either in person or on the page. A while ago, a new fellow, not a classicist, saw a reference letter by Jim, and at first thought it was a rather severe account of the work of a second-rater. In fact, as we knew, and as she realized once she encountered Jim's true charm, it was a glowing appreciation of a scholar of the very first rank. For me, Jim was in his element at tea in All Souls, on the straight back chair by the windows in the common room, jacket and tie, and those brown shoes gleaming. And of his dry-witted gems, one that I particularly fondly recall, it was on a spring afternoon very much like this, was his denunciation of bank holiday Mondays. They don't just ruin the day itself, they blight the whole week. Of course, with that slight twinkle in the eye. The tributes today will be accompanied by music played by Jonathan Katz. And let me say that our tradition, and I'm sure Jim would approve, is no applause, please, after each piece. I think it is very fitting in two ways, this music. The first thing is to let you know that the first three pieces were often played by and were chosen by Jim's daughter Elena, who unfortunately can't be with us this afternoon. So it's fitting very much in that sense. Also in that Jonathan is the pianist, because Jonathan speaks Latin regularly, because he is the public orator of this university. But one public orator is not enough for Jim. And so after some Chopin, our first speaker will be the public orator of Trinity College, Dublin. Thank you again very much indeed for coming. Thank you.
It is a privilege to see so many of Jim's closest friends here. Friends he had many. Such was his ability to connect with people instantly, and more often than not discover connections between the person he just met and people he knew, places he'd been. I've often wondered, although he would hate me for saying that, whether he believed in a universe of interconnected human stories, just as he trained himself to spot similarities between distant Latin records and patterns in the diverse linguistic phenomena he studied. For us gathered here, Jim was a close friend, a colleague, a teacher, mentor, advisor. Each of us could say with Plautus, one of Jim's favorite Latin poets, perhaps one of the few Latin poets he actually liked, Iam diu ego uic bene et icmi volumus et amicitia est antiqua. For a long time, he and I have been fond of each other, and our friendship is old. Some of his old friends couldn't be here today, and I am most grateful to those who have been kind enough to get in touch with me as I was preparing for this somewhat unconventional memorial service, which was deliberately intended to involve as many voices as possible. You all know that, but I will just say that Jim came to Oxford for the first time from the University of Sydney as a Commonwealth Scholar in 1967. And he would spend the rest of his 55-odd years in the UK, never returning to his homeland. In his long career as a Latinist in this country, Jim always remained, by his own proud admission, Australian. For someone who always encouraged us to challenge received doctrines and unsupported opinions, Jim retained, or perhaps developed over time, an uncharacteristic nostalgia for his homeland. 5 or 6 years ago, Patrick Finglas sent him a photograph of Sydney University from a lecturing tour of Australia he was doing, and Jim was delighted to circulate it, pointing out that Greek was at the left as you look, Latin at the right of the building. Even through a typically dry one-liner of an email, one could feel Jim's emotion as he contemplated the place where it had all started. In 1970, Jim obtained a fellowship at Cambridge, where he moved in a memorable journey in Tony Woodman's Volvo, accompanied by Bill Barnes, another Sydney alumnus. With both scholars, Jim remained in touch all his life. In 1972, he came to Manchester, where he spent over 23 years, having been appointed as lecturer in Greek and Latin in 1972. He had been preceded by John Briscoe in 1968, by David Bain in 1971, and was followed by Harry Joslin in 1973. More friends for life. When Jim was appointed, the then Hume Professor of Greek commented to John Briscoe that if you or I, quote, had been candidates, we wouldn't have stood a chance. And that was meant as a compliment to everyone involved, I believe. Jim's knowledge of Latin was phenomenal, his memory and clear thinking astounding. Harry Joslin, who had taught him in Sydney, once told me that he soon realized that there wasn't much left for anyone to teach Jim in terms of Latin. And Manchester, Jim, Harry, David, and John constituted a gang of four, as John Briscoe put it to me, meaning that they were all active researchers as opposed to just teachers, as was possible at the time. And Jim's and Harry's interest in the lowest registers of Latin, followed by David Bain's on the Greek side, brought about the research environment that came to be known as the Manchester Institute of Classical Obscenity. most famous for Jim's Latin sexual vocabulary. As a teacher, Jim always taught the first year course in Latin languages and was famously in the habit to tell students that they didn't know any Latin, a phrase he would apply to practically every Latin scholar of his times, including myself and maybe others. But he was not arrogant. He just knew that his own understanding of how the language worked was unrivaled. And naturally, at the time, in his first job at Manchester that lasted for so long, he also offered special subjects in early and late Latin, which were to become two special interests to him. Perhaps not everyone knows that Jim was also an efficient and even enthusiastic administrator, as his former colleagues at Manchester and Reading still recall. He did not believe in meetings. Sitting around the table is a form of idleness, he would say. And yet he was head of department both at Manchester and then at Reading. And at Reading he came as a professor of Latin in 1995 and remained for 3 years. Jane Gardner, who unfortunately cannot be with us today, observed that, quote, Jim rather prided himself on being abrasive, but in practice, staff and student alike found him to be kind, supportive, and utterly lacking in self-importance. And she therefore felt, I would say, that she could tease him with impunity, and she did so frequently. My own very first job was at Reading in 1997 as a teaching replacement for Jim, who was on sabbatical that year leading up to his appointment at All Souls, an utterly terrifying experience. When I first met Jim a few years earlier, I was a visiting student, PhD student from Pisa, studying at Manchester under the supervision of Harry Jocelyn. That was the academic year 1994-1995. And I mention this because that's also the time and the place where Roy Gibson, who also cannot be with us today, was just starting his career. And I cannot beat what Roy wrote to me of his experience because it matches verbatim my own and that of many others. So please allow me to conclude by quoting Roy when he said, I can say that Jim was extraordinarily kind to me as a young lecturer in my first job at Manchester. He read all my work and spontaneously offered to read it too, introduced me to Latin linguistics, and did me the honour of treating me seriously as a fellow scholar, which I did not deserve. In this, he set me an unforgettable example that I have consciously tried to emulate since. Unquote. I did not deserve it, and I have followed that example. And at difficult times, I still hear Jim's repeated advice to me, get a grip on yourself and soldier on.
Well, my thanks to the warden and to the organisers for the privilege of speaking at this event about a very, very old friend of mine, and apologies in advance for a slight overlap with some of what Anna has already said. Jim and I took up lectureships at Manchester University on the same day in September 1972, although in different departments. I was in the large history department and he was in Latin and Greek, one of the several who objected to it being called classics. It was a department which, as Anna has noted, had some very distinguished members in the past and continued to do so. Jim joined the department with a significant scholarly presence, including, as she said, John Briscoe and the late David Bain, and he added to it very considerably. I know that he justifiably felt that the weight of scholarship, as well as the Australian flavour in the department, was significantly enhanced by the appointment of Harry Joslin. And I know that a key role in that appointment was certainly played by the then Professor of Ancient History, R.E. Smith, who was my professor, of course, in the history department, and he had been Harry's professor in Sydney. Harry, of course, also added immeasurably to the scholarly weight of that department, but it must be said that he was not a comfortable presence in the administration. In fact, the most vivid and, I think, to my recollection, very accurate account of what the department was like and what Harry did to it is given by Jim himself in his British Academy obituary memoir of Harry Joslin. This is, of course, not a speech about Harry, but the character of the department. Harry was direct or even brutal in expressing his views in public, but, of course, he and Jim became very good friends with close and complementary scholarly interests, and that memoir of Harry tells us a lot about Jim too. And I'm glad to say I got on well with, but of course with Jim, but also with Harry, which was probably rather good for my peace of mind in the next door department. My personal memories of those years, in my case, it was just 5 years. Jim, of course, stayed a lot longer, as Anna has noted. They were full of quirkiness. They were full of good, if always rather, deadpan humour and great fun. We lived with our families in Didsbury, probably no more than 50 yards apart. And I would like to say that I remember many wonderful dinner parties with Jim and Genevieve, although in truth I remember rather less than I should because of Jim's habit of serving brutally large scotches as aperitifs before the dinner, which sometimes made it a struggle to get through. But they were all good fun. Jim soon abandoned the habit of reducing his guests to that state even before dinner. We argued about football. Jim, of course, was on the wrong side. I once persuaded him to cross to the blue side, and he spent 90 minutes complaining about it vigorously. We played a good deal of cricket together, although not always on the same side, because I was playing largely for the Manchester University staff team, which was quite a decent side, and Jim played rather better level of cricket in the Manchester Association, where he was really quite considerable off-spinner. And, of course, we argued about the Ashes. As the Ashes are generally won by the Australians, I expect the arguments were probably also won by Jim. In those years, Jim was also a hypochondriac of Olympic standards. He once told me that his GP had said to him, after only a year in Manchester, that Jim's file was the fattest in the surgery. And of course, again, as Anna has noted, he was an inveterate non-traveller, deeply suspicious of any form of transport except perhaps the motor car. He never returned to Australia. There's a famous story about him having aborted his one and only attempt to fly back there, and he never even visited Italy, despite knowing a little bit, more than a little bit, about his languages, I should say. So during those years, he and Harry, as Anna has also already noted, were responsible for earning Manchester's reputation as what somebody described to me as the leading centre for the study of dirty words in Latin. That was, of course, the preoccupation which was to culminate in his 1982 book on the Latin sexual vocabulary. I occasionally had a personal debt to that book too, because I do certainly remember occasionally being approached for a Latin motto, an obscene Latin motto, for which I had to go recourse to his book to find out exactly what to say. One of those, I have to say, came from a clergyman, not English, not British even. Veterinary terminology, of course, was also the subject of his close attention at that period, before he moved on to the broader themes of his big books. These precise and meticulous studies eschewed sensationalism or meretriciousness, as he always did in every respect. And I will remember that in respect of teaching, I remember his defence of the principle that undergraduate lectures should be as boring as possible because the students were there to learn, not to be entertained. From 1975 onwards, David Thomas, Jim and I became close collaborators in the work on the Vindolanda tablets, and that was work which continued right through until the end of his life. In fact, poignantly, an email I sent him on the morning of his death, inevitably with a linguistic question, might have been the last communication which he read. Yvetta told me that, but it sadly went unanswered. I'm going to have to find somebody else to ask that question of. We had, David and I, quickly realised that we were out of depth in many detailed technical questions on the linguistic side, and we relied on him implicitly. His contributions to our understanding of the language and the syntax of the text were vital, and it seems clear that this material, along with the discoveries at Bath, Carlisle and London, made a great contribution to his understanding of the regional development of the Latin language. And in this work, as elsewhere, he was acutely conscious of the possibility, even probability, that new evidence could totally undermine a firmly held opinion, and he did have firmly held opinions, so even his own could be overturned. In fact, David Thomas and I were once firmly criticised by him for publishing a statement on a linguistic poem which he himself had given us. A mutual friend, Marilyn Deegan, once of this university, once told me, quoted to me an obiter dictum of Genevieve, his first wife, which was to the effect that when Jim says never, he means maybe tomorrow. And as the Vindolanda work goes on, even today, I must say that I feel deeply bereft of an incomparable support as well as a very close friend. It's wonderful to be able to remember him in this wonderful setting of All Souls College, but I hope I'm allowed to close by repeating, as Anna has already said, that Jim was also deeply fond of Brasenose College too, where he spent his postgraduate years in the 1960s, and I was personally delighted that the college elected him to an honorary fellowship during the time when I was principal. That gave us both very great pleasure indeed. Thank you.
Thank you. I count my friendship with Jim as not only one of the great blessings of my life, but one of the most surprising. I was something of an anomaly. I am something of an anomaly among his acquaintance. I am not a classicist. I'm not an academic. And indeed, I am two of the things that he most frequently anathematized, a POM and a member of the Church of England. But I think Jim quite enjoyed that because he was something of an anomaly himself. We first met when I was a visiting fellow at All Souls. I was here completing a biography of the Gothic Revival architect A.W.N. Pugin. And Jim was, I think, at the time, the only fellow here who knew much about Pugin, and he sought me out to talk about him. Jim himself was a collector, in a modest but very well-informed way, of historic furniture. He was interested in designers from Pugin to Gordon Russell, and he had a particular fondness for the Lancaster firm of Gillows. And Jim was very anxious to identify historic items in the college's somewhat mixed accumulation of furniture. He greatly overestimated my connoisseurship. This caused me to be marched into the rooms of a number of fellows and members of staff, all of whom were surprised and some visibly annoyed to be told that I had come to examine their chairs. Jim, as we all know, did a brilliant impersonation of an old stick, but nothing pleased him more than to have his disguise seen through. And I realized early on in our acquaintanceship how maverick he was in his opinions and how kind. But our real friendship began later when Jim was Dean of Visiting Fellows, and he was, as we've heard, a very assiduous administrator. Like all former visiting fellows, I had certain dining rights, but I'd never taken them up. Why not? Jim demanded tersely by email. I explained that I was under the impression that, perhaps just in my case, they were offered without much enthusiasm, in the way that people say we must have lunch, when what they mean is we will never meet again. This made Jim even crosser, so we duly arranged for me to come back and dine. And from that evening, the notion that I might come back again to All Souls as a two-year fellow was born. It was Jim's idea, and it changed my life. The fellowship, which I took up at Michaelmas 2009, enabled me to research the book on antiquarianism, Time's Witness, which I finally published last summer. And I'm so glad that Jim was able to know about it, because it owed a lot to him. When I was here, I gave a series of seminars in college, and he came to all of them. His was mostly a supportive but silent presence, except on one occasion when a medievalist asked what he considered a naive question. And then it was like the moment in the wildlife documentary when the snake shoots out of the undergrowth and takes down a small mammal. After which, with that little thing he used to do with his shoulders, he sat back looking quite pleased. If I'd known at the beginning of our acquaintanceship how very distinguished a scholar Jim was, I would never have sent him the little bits of Latin that puzzled me in the correspondence of the Georgian antiquaries whose work I was studying. But he always translated them for me by return, which was very helpful. He also corrected them, which was less useful as all the authors had been dead for more than a century. After we had both left the college, our correspondence continued, and it was a constant source of pleasure, enriched with the small change of both our lives. It ranged over my friend Jonathan Meads, who Jim admired very much because when Jonathan was the restaurant critic of the Sunday Times, he had the chutzpah to award Planet Hollywood no stars at all. And we talked about the varying stages of our work in progress. Footnote checking, which Jim, of course, found amazingly boring. Printers, infuriating. And the general exasperatingness of the world. I long ago lost count of the number of sentences that Jim started with the phrase, "Some fool." We talked about Knutsford, where he had his flat, a town on which the architectural activities of Richard Harding Watt in the 19th century imposed what Pevsner calls a crazy grandeur of buildings whose idiosyncrasy naturally appealed to Jim. Over the years, of course, we had our troubles. I was widowed twice. He was increasingly often unwell. He spoke of these things openly, and always with compassion. Of the passage of time, he remarked to me not so long ago that the idea of hope changes with the years. We had one last plan to meet in the autumn, which had to be postponed, and there were to be no more. But I'm left with a profound sense of gratitude. Dear Jim, thank you.
A little more than half a year has passed since Jim left us. On so many occasions, whenever something absurd or funny happens in classics, or when something big or small is happening in my life, I find myself thinking I must tell Jim about it, only to realize a moment later that I can't. And this is perhaps what I miss most about Jim, not being able to email him anymore and to receive an amused reaction or a much-needed piece of advice. I first met Jim in 2000 at his Plautus lectures. Our shared interest in Plautine language gave us much to talk about for years and years. But in 2000, I didn't really get to know Jim yet. I saw him as an occasional guest at a philology seminar, and I had a few tutorials with him. But in 2004, he was my DPhil examiner, and this is when we started to talk more regularly. Jim supported my application to a postdoctoral fellowship at All Souls at a time when I was actually thinking of giving up academia. And when I started in 2005, he became my mentor. This mentorship did not end when I left All Souls in 2009, but continued uninterrupted till the very end. About 2 weeks into my fellowship, Jim asked me to see him in his office. I was finding it quite difficult to find my feet in this new place, and although I thought I could conceal it, Jim wasn't fooled. He asked me whether I was getting used to college, and when I said yes, he replied it couldn't be true. He said he had been here for many, many years longer than me and still wasn't used to it, and every time he thought he was getting used to it, he added, something grotesque or bizarre would happen and he would feel like a complete alien again. Jim said all of this in a way that made me laugh, but behind that shared laughter, there was also Jim's characteristic care and concern. And from that day onwards, I knew I could tell Jim any worry I had, big or small, and he would listen and try his best to help. And although I don't have to say this, Jim was undoubtedly the greatest scholar of the Latin language alive, he would also ask for advice. And he consulted me on meter and various Plautine issues. And to a young scholar who is just starting out, there's nothing more inspiring than being consulted by someone who is clearly a star, an absolute star. So without ever actively pushing me, Jim made me work harder than I believed possible. We all know Jim as a scholar of the ancient world, but he knew everything about antiques, paintings, and wine as well, and none of this knowledge was paraded around. When a wine connoisseur in college droned on about the 7 types of tannin you can taste in wine, apparently, Jim restored a quieter atmosphere by saying very loudly that he only had 2 adjectives for wine, good and bad. His sense of humor was remarkable. It was very dry, to the point, and yet never hurtful. There was often an element of playful exaggeration, as when he was asked whether Australians still called the British Poms. And he said, no, this is not a genuine Australian expression. There's a very affectionate term, may not sound affectionate, but it's meant in an affectionate way. And that is Pommy bastard, as in, dry as a pommy bastard's towel. I don't know if such a phrase actually existed before Jim coined it. Today, we remember Jim as a scholar without equal. But the Jim I remember was, above all, a truly generous friend, witty, with the kindest heart, and with a loyalty to his friends that cannot be surpassed. I will miss our Jim forever.
It is a great honour to be asked to speak in memory of someone I first met in 1978 when I was a very nervous graduate student giving my first ever paper at the invitation of Harry Jocelyn, and what a pleasure it was to meet someone who would become a lifelong friend. In fact, they both did, of course, and also both their wives. So thank you, Warden, for asking me to speak today. Of all Jim Adams's characteristics, surely one of the most salient was his generosity towards younger scholars, regardless whether they'd ever published anything or had any letters other than BA after their name. I wonder how many people here have reached the point in doctoral or pre-doctoral supervision at which the only advice to give a student was, ask Jim Adams. Jim gave unstinting help to other people's students on distant continents. It is that generosity that I want to honor today. To pin down some of the characteristic ways in which he cast his advice and the type of lesson that he transmitted, I have, with my students' permission, plundered the archives of his correspondence with them. Those emails in which his quirks and convictions are abundantly on display is how he gave other people's students their training. One particularly vivid example revolves around a fragmentary and highly technical late Latin text on fruit trees by Gargilius Martialis, you don't have to have heard of him, that captured the imagination of a Harvard student, James Analdine, in 2015. After James had spent months working on this text, it was time for him to subject a sample to Jim's critical eye. Jim put the sample in his queue. After a while, the correspondence began, with the signature opening line, "Dear James, having seen off various irritating obligations, I can now have a look at your Gargilius." As Jim explained, his preferred method for working on drafts was a little bit at a time. So a series of emails started to arrive in James's inbox, up to 3 in a single day, punctuated, presumably, by more of the irritating obligations, or maybe lunch. The Adams method was to ask more than to tell. The questions came thick and fast. The project was ultimately published as a Cambridge Orange. The stamp of Jim's influence is evident throughout. Jim insisted on independence of thought. His iconoclastic streak rebelled against what he called the tyranny of an old doctrine. He urged James to address the phenomena with an open mind, freed of doctrines from the past. Compound for simplex was one of these, together with its alleged label of early and archaic. Alleged cropped up quite often in Jim's notes, as did the skeptical judgment, "I would doubt the truth of so-and-so's remark." Notably, blunt judgments on published scholarship, such as X or Y has mistranslated grossly, were expressed to friends, but never to their students. Professional etiquette was part of the lesson. We all relied on Jim's remarkable grasp on the bibliography of the field to supply us with the right pointers. Books that were inadequately indexed annoyed him. When he wanted James to consult Harm Pinkster's Latin syntax, as he put it, "one has to plow through the contents, hoping for the best." His frustration was almost audible. Frequently, of course, he would direct his correspondence to his own work. Having suggested to James that on one point he might look at the discussion of a detail in the Latin sexual vocabulary, he added disarmingly, "Also worth noting is the correction of one of my assertions by David Bain," plus page and footnote number, of course. The self-mockery in the word assertions is characteristic. Parallels from modern languages, while often interesting, Jim regarded as no substitute for parallels from Latin itself. Any generalizations must be based on explicit references to the language. The jargon of sociolinguistics he recognized as useful, but potentially alienating to the uninitiated. Somewhat opaque was his judgment on the sociolinguistic label non-facultative directive that another of our students, Emily Mitchell, used in an analysis of master-slave interactions in Plautus. Jim was not against using jargon, but it had to be clear in the context, so that readers would not have to consult a sociolinguistic dictionary. His advice to Emily was simple. The first time she used such a term, she should cite some Latin evidence with selective explanation. Quoting the Latin was always fundamental to his method. Jim's vast acquaintance with subliterary Latin chimed with his suspicion of hierarchies. In his opinion, removing linguistic anomalies by emendation amounted almost to a dereliction of scholarly duty. He insisted that the impulse of textual critics to interfere with the transmitted text cannot absolve the sociolinguist of responsibility for finding linguistic reasons for apparently unorthodox forms and usage. His advice to James on this point was crisp. A classicist may be tempted to rewrite according to classical norms, and that may not be appropriate in a technical work. Reading over the emails that Jim sent some of the Harvard students over the years, I'm struck by their clarity and precision. His exclusive goal was to help potential scholars to introduce rigor into their thinking and increase our understanding of Latin and how it works. He had no time for stroking egos. As he put it to James, "I'm not bothering to keep showering praise on you, but I'm sticking to things that might, at least in my opinion, need some improvement." To which he added, "So take no notice of my direct tone." That direct tone was a lodestar to so many of us. With Jim, even if you were a graduate student who had never met him, you knew exactly what you had to do.
Thank you very much to all of you for being here today, and forgive me for starting from a personal experience, simple yet fundamental for me, which I think also encapsulates a core feature of Jim's work and personality, which I would like to talk about in my brief speech. This experience dates to the early years of my relationship with him, and it was in the second year of my DPhil, it's actually the second term of my DPhil, in the first year, and I had just discovered a new book in the acquisition shelf of the Sackler, which dealt with the same topic I had been working on in the previous months. This book presented new evidence and a fresh analysis of it that made my own claims and results, the fruit of months of hard work, either redundant or patently incorrect. I won't bore you with the details, but I will simply read what Jim wrote to me in response to a despondent email. If you confirm some of his conclusions, and that he is this scholar, the author of the book, there is nothing wrong with that, as the aim is to get at the truth. The scholar must present things in the way that is correct and in line with the evidence. And if this is where your evidence is leading, so be it. There is plenty in your own paper that is not in his, and there is still much to be said. The simple words had a dramatic effect on me, not just because of its content, but especially, I would say, because of its language. Truth was a taboo word that my generation had learned to avoid, a potential threat evoking shadows of dogmatism superseded in our 21st century liberal society. At the same time, the idea of being led by evidence and that there is still too much to be said smacked of an empiricist optimism and a belief in objective research, which again sounded naive to a millennial like myself, grown in the age of relativism and skepticism, where intellectual brilliance is often equated to power of argumentation or waffling, in Jim's terms, and research is substituted with self-reflection, self-promotion, or propaganda of any color. Moreover, to my young postmodern self, Jim's words seemed to contrast with this personality as I had begun to know and admire him, a tolerant, open-minded, generous man with a profoundly non-hierarchical approach to teaching and research, allergic to any kind of rhetoric, theory, or ideology, brandishing a sarcastic, desecrating wit, and able to make strong bonds with people from any kind of social and cultural background. And even his work appeared to me as the opposite of the traditionalism and the elitism which I associated the word truth at that time. Few like him managed to expand so much the discipline of classics, going beyond the narrowness of the canonical corpus, challenging received dogmas and doctrines, debunking the mythology and the fetishization of classical Latin, giving real space to the voice of non-elite, and thereby uncovering the complexity and the variety of the ancient world. Few like him had been so perceptive to new trends and discourses, from gender studies to social linguistics, and so ready to integrate them into their work in their own way, breaking new ground, addressing broad questions with unparalleled attention for detail, and thereby setting the agenda for the following decades. In time, I've learned that that concern for truth, transpiring from Jim's email, was not in contrast with everything I knew about him, but rather was at its foundation. Getting at the truth is the underlying goal that has placed the rigor and the clarity of Jim's work, his humility and keenness to learn from others, his interest and generosity for other scholars of any age, as we heard, as well, I will say, as his caution and integrity, which often led him to admit that nothing certain could be said about a particular question, or that his former assertions were provisional or improvable. The same love for truth is also the roots of Jim's intellectual curiosity, his freedom, and his openness. Few like him, for instance, and that's something which always struck me, have made use of such a wide range of bibliography of any language and of any age, from 19th century German scholarship to contemporary American theory. Finally, I think that all this I said also explains why Jim's work has been so original, so seminal and so relevant, and not just in the field of Latin linguistics, in whose existence he didn't believe, as you may have heard. As Anna Shaoud recently wrote, ahead of the times, in a no-nonsense and non-ideological way, Jim Adams addressed topics pertinent to contemporary anxieties about the future of the discipline in the current climate of revision and decolonization. To conclude, I'm very grateful to Jim, not just for supporting me in a moment of despondency about my research and perhaps about research in general, but more importantly, I thank him for helping me to overcome that false contrast between respect for evidence and inclusivity, between tradition and innovation, between rigor and relevance, and above all, between aiming at truth and being aware that one's truth is always partial and provisional, and that there is still much to be said, as Jim wrote to me many years ago. In this sense, Jim's work will not simply be, many years to come, a must-read for anyone interested in the Latin language, but it will also continue to offer guidance and inspiration for many classical scholars, teaching the lesson that ideology is always pernicious, even if well-intended, that the study of language requires and fosters attention and a positive approach to research that should be maintained in all fields, and that love for truth is not a threat, but rather a compass to navigate the challenges of our discipline. In this speech, as you heard, I used the word love a few times, although I'm well aware of Jim's aversions for any sentimentality. And yet the people who know him well, and we knew him well, understood that beneath the persona, the mask of the caustic Don, there was in fact a warm, generous heart, filled with affection for his family, for his friends, and for his field of research. And it is this affection which perhaps we miss above anything else.